Why France losing its AAA credit rating is much worse than us losing ours. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. Our podcast from Marketplace.org today is Monday, January 16th, Martin Luther King Day. Coming up, how in the world could a modern cruise liner sink off the coast of Italy? Is the lack of snow across the U.S. an indication that we're heading into a national drought? And who wants to buy a fax machine? Apparently somebody in South America. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
U.S. markets are closed today, and that might be a good thing because right after Wall Street closed on Friday, the ratings agency Standard & Poor's dropped another bombshell. The firm downgraded the credit ratings of 9 European nations. France and Austria both lost their prized AAA credit ratings. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on this story. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, this is being seen as a bigger deal, I guess, than your run-of-the-mill downgrade, in part because France lost its AAA rating. And I have to ask why that's such a big deal, because it happened here in the U.S. and didn't seem to cause much of a problem.
The U.S. is different, Jeremy, because of the dollar. I mean, it still is seen as a safe haven in turbulent times. Enough people are still prepared to lend to the U.S., and that keeps U.S. borrowing costs down. You can't say the same about the euro. Some even question whether it'll survive. So those mass eurozone downgrades are certainly more damaging than the U.S. downgrade.
And what about this other piece of euro news that we got on Friday that some people said was actually a bigger deal than the downgrades, and that is a collapse of the debt talks in Greece?
Yeah, potentially. This is more serious. I mean, these are talks aimed at easing Greece's debt burden by writing a lot of it off in an orderly fashion. The banks and others that lent money to Greece are involved in these negotiations, but they were asked to take a bigger hit than they expected, and they stormed out on Friday. Now, Martina Stevis of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal says this doesn't mean the talks are over.
Obviously, as any negotiation reaching its final stretch, the negotiating parties will bring in all the techniques and all the tactics. Walking out and banging the door behind you is quite a common tactic.
Those debt talks resume on Wednesday, but Martina says there's a big danger here. Greece has got to borrow a lot of money on March the 20th. It could run out of time. It could suffer an accidental default.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, let's get reaction now from Rob Carnell. He's chief international economist with ING, and he's with us from London. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Well, it does seem like these ratings agencies have still got an enormous sway in the debt crisis in Europe. How important are these downgrades?
I think they're much less important than they once were. I think there have been periods during this debt crisis in the eurozone where the ratings agencies have come in and downgraded countries and really had an enormous impact, you know, just at the point where they were reeling. They've come in and given them another kick. But I think this latest batch of downgrades, they were quite well flagged. I mean, we didn't know exactly when the timing was going to be, but we had a very good idea they were coming for countries like France. And I think it hasn't caused quite as big an upset as would have happened. You mentioned that the stock market movements today, they're broadly flat to up slightly. And looking at the bond market as well, the movements actually yields, typically these would rise substantially on a downgrade. If anything, yields today on government benchmark bonds are down slightly. So maybe the impact isn't as big as it used to be.
Meaning that borrowing costs for these countries are going down, not up. Quickly,
exactly.
Rob, I mean, have the ratings agencies lost any of their credibility, given all that's happened with their ratings on mortgage-backed securities in the crisis and even these countries now?
Yeah, I think they have done, and I mean there are calls by European politicians to replace the sort of private U.S. ratings companies with a European version. I'm not sure that would be any more credible. And the reasons that companies like S&P have set out for these downgrades, they're very open, they're quite formulaic, matrix-driven, they're pretty obvious, quite hard to argue with, actually.
That's Rob Carnell. He's chief international economist with ING. Well, rescue operations have been suspended on the sunken cruise ship just off the Italian coast. The cruise ship hit a reef on Friday night. There was a frantic evacuation of about 4,200 people. At least six people have died, 16 remain unaccounted for, and rescue attempts were halted briefly this morning when the ship slipped in the water in rough seas. For some context, we turn to cruise ship industry analyst Julian Bray, who's with us from Cambridge, England. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how are people like you who watch the cruise ship industry making sense of this disaster? What went wrong here?
Everything. This is a disaster on so many different levels. You have a 21st century cruise ship, state-of-the-art, is built by one of the leading shipbuilders in Italy. It has state-of-the-art navigation systems. It is quite inconceivable that this could happen, and everything seems to have gone wrong here.
How thorough are the policies about safety when it comes to cruise ships compared to, say, the airline industry?
I would have said until all this happened that they were even better than the airline industries. American companies normally require that a muster drill is carried out within hours. In fact, the industry standard is within 24 hours. But as soon as you go into your stateroom, you will see a video, which is repeated on all channels, so you can't click it off, which gives you the basic information. You have a huge chart on the back of your door, which actually plots your route to the nearest exit. And when you open your wardrobe, you will find two life vests in there. So naturally, you have to move those before you can get your clothes in. So already you are handling safety equipment. And then very, very quickly, they will call you for a muster, and everybody has to attend. It's quite compulsory.
Julian, what kind of repercussions is this going to have on the industry as you see it at this point?
This is going to be quite a blow, because now is the season for actually thinking about your next holiday. Season cruisers, if you like to call them that, will probably not have too much of a problem with it. But the essential new cruise market, those who are new to cruising, will certainly think twice about it, because if they're going to take your family on what should be a complete floating city, it's supposed to be safe, so you can take your children on there, they will look at this and think. However, I would say to everybody, please remember that as a result of this disaster, and we must acknowledge that six people have died here and 16 are unaccounted for, that lessons will be learned, and hopefully some good will come out of this very black moment for the industry.
Julian Bray is a cruise ship industry analyst. Thank you so much, Julian.
Thank you, sir.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Voters in Taiwan went to the polls over the weekend and narrowly reelected Ma Ying-jeou to a second term as president. And Ma's victory is being seen as a show of popular support for closer economic ties between Taiwan and China. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has more now from Shanghai.
President Ma held a press conference after his victory. He summed up the priorities of Taiwanese voters nervous about the local impact of a global economic downturn. Economy first, politics later, Ma said. In the past 4 years, Ma Ying-jeou has helped Taiwan strengthen economic and political ties with China. Chung-Pin Lin, professor of international affairs at Taiwan's Tom Kong University, says the Taiwanese voted for the man who could sustain that relationship.
Economic stability this time is real and is a widely shared concern in the election.
It's a shared concern with the U.S. and Europe, too.
High-level people in Washington and in Canberra and in Tokyo and in the European capitals want to have some peace and stability in the world.
Monash University professor Bruce Jacobs is an expert on Taiwan politics.
Anything which keeps the Chinese happy, I think, is keeping some of the policymakers happy as well.
That's because China is one of the few remaining countries with rapid economic growth. It owns more than $1 trillion of U.S. debt, and U.S. companies are making more and more money there. Upsetting China could upset the bottom line. Jacob says Ma's win may please Beijing, but it also serves as a reminder to an authoritarian state that democracy is alive and well in Taiwan. There was 74% voter turnout on Saturday, and nearly 200,000 overseas Taiwanese who live in China went home just to vote.
When you actually have a democracy that's functioning, such as in Taiwan, and there's only four consolidated democracies in all of Asia, this is something valuable. It's something that should be encouraged.
It certainly wasn't encouraged by Beijing. China's government reportedly ordered mainland tour groups visiting Taiwan to stay inside their hotels on the day of election. That meant they didn't get any ideas from watching democracy in action. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Now to Abu Dhabi, where the UN Secretary General said today he wants the world to double its share of renewable energy by the year 2030. World leaders are gathered in Abu Dhabi for the World Future Energy Summit to talk about boosting the use of wind, solar, and other renewable sources of power. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
So a summit on renewable energy in a desert kingdom funded by oil? Well, it's not a total stretch, says Shail Khan. He's director of solar at GTM Research.
You would want to be having a conversation about the future of energy smack dab in the center of the energy world.
That energy world, in total, is mostly fossil fuels. You won't see any deals inked in Abu Dhabi to change that. But United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants to help the poorest nations avoid using more coal and oil.
The goal of leapfrogging fossil fuels and going straight to renewables is admirable, and I hope that we're going to get there.
Severin Borenstein heads the Energy Institute at Berkeley's Haas School of Business.
But rolling out the current technology is really much more expensive still in most locations than burning fossil fuels.
He says the developing nations' main goals are to grow their economies and reduce poverty. And as long as fossil fuel is cheaper, they'll use it. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Zimbabwe has banned imports of secondhand underwear. The government says it's protecting the health and dignity of Zimbabwean women. But many Zimbabweans aren't happy about the change because they say it's the only underwear that many people can afford. For today's Midday Extra, the BBC's Brian Hungwe reports from the capital, Harare.
68% of Zimbabweans live in poverty, so they already buy many of their clothes secondhand. But secondhand underwear has been a particular big seller here in recent years because it's cheaper and considered better quality than new underwear imported from places like China. Most of the secondhand underwear is shipped to Zimbabwe from mainly European charities. You can buy three pairs of underwear for a dollar in most flea markets here in Harare. Customers and traders here say it's clean and safe, so they are angered by the ban. Priscilla Mshonga is a Zimbabwean government minister. The ban was her idea. For her, it's a moral rather than an economic issue.
I can't for the life of me understand how it is possible that women are reduced to using second-hand underwear.
She says it's unhygienic, undignified, and carries health risks. The Zimbabwean government aren't backing down over this ban, but they plan to help out local consumers struggling to buy cheap underwear by encouraging the domestic textile industry to fill the gap. In Harare, I'm the BBC's Brian Hungwe for Marketplace.
Now to Chicago, which has been auctioning off unneeded city property to make ends meet, everything from cars to Xerox copier toners. According to the Chicago Sun-Times, the city raked in $3.6 million from the auctions last year. That's twice what it made in 2010, thanks in part to a big sale of standalone fax machines to an unnamed South American government, which apparently still communicates by fax. Well, today would ordinarily be one of the busiest days of the year at the nation's ski resorts since it's the tail end of a holiday weekend. But the lack of snow across the West this year has made skiing impossible in many places. Some are wondering if we're officially in a drought. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports on the official definition of drought.
Turns out drought is just like the markets. It's all about supply, that's the rain, but also demand. Mark Sivboda is a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center.
Drought is something different to just about everyone you talk to. There's no universal definition for drought.
And generally says drought starts with too little precipitation over a certain amount of time.
When that impacts you, that's when you're in a drought.
Those impacts have to do with precipitation, sure, but also other people. David Miskus is a meteorologist with the Climate Prediction Center for the federal government.
Sometimes you can get normal rainfall, but if the demand is much higher than normal, you remove the reservoir much quicker than you think, and then they consider that kind of like a man-made drought.
Like the markets, drought is about scarcity and expectations. It's all about the numbers and what they mean to us. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we'll find out how fast the Chinese economy is growing. Economists are expecting to see a little bit of a slowdown, but we're still talking about an annual rate of 8.5% or so. Now, as China's economy has boomed, Chinese people have been buying a lot more stuff, from houses to iPhones to cars. And cars in developing countries like China and India are the subject now of our quiz with Quizmaster Stefan Richter. He's editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Jeremy. Ready for today's quiz?
I am ready.
All right. As you said, thousands of new drivers in China and India are all getting behind the wheel every day with their new car. If the entire world had the same rate of car ownership as we have in the United States, how many cars would be on the world's roads?
Hmm.
Would it be 1.7 billion cars, 4 billion cars, 5.5 billion cars, or just a tad under 7 billion cars?
All right, I'm going to go with B, 4 billion cars. I don't really think that we could more than quadruple the number of cars if everyone was driving like we do in the U.S.
That would be true and is true if only we'd be like West Europeans. Mm. The West Europeans have roughly 580 cars per 1,000 people. But of course, we Americans outdo them, so you have to up your guess a little bit, I would think.
All right, then I'll go with answer C, 5.5 billion cars, although that seems like a huge number considering what, there are only 7 billion people in the world right now.
Exactly. And that, of course, is what mathematically would be forecast if we all did like Americans.
Wow.
That's an impossibility. Even as we stand after the Durban summit with all the pollution that we still have to get rid of. But remember this, the only good news is that the IEA, the Paris-based International Energy Agency, assumes we'll have 1.7 billion cars on the road by 2035. Other industry forecasts are more 4 billion, but of course you wouldn't expect any other forecasts from the Fords and other companies of this world.
How many cars do you have, Stefan?
We have one. We're a very enlightened family.
Uh-huh.
I mostly use the subway and the bike, and we just use the car for things where we really can't schlep it on our backs or walk it.
Stefan Richter, clearly a good environmentalist and editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And finally, to a new mobile phone app for dating aliens. The intergalactic dating app will send radio frequencies from your phone into outer space so you can communicate with other life forms and maybe find a mate. The first version, which is still in development, isn't quite universal, though. It'll only be accessible to aliens up to 1 light year or 6 trillion miles from Earth. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.